The Federalist Society is once again very pleased to welcome a longtime friend, Senator Ted Cruz.
It is great to be with a lot of old and dear friends who have for so many years been toiling in the fields, fighting to defend individual liberty, fighting to defend economic liberty, fighting to defend the rule of law and the Constitution. And the Federalist Society is a wonderful institution. As y'all know, we just finished hearings on Judge Neil Gorsuch, during which there were more than a few questions from Democratic senators that I'm pretty sure went along the lines of, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Federalist Society? I went ahead and self-reported, yes, I am. For now, a majority of my life, really quite terrifying, I joined as a 1L at age 21, and sadly, I now have more years beyond that point than before that point, which really scares me. But I suppose it is preferable to the alternative.
Not being a Federalist Society.
I like that. As Dean thinks about death and not being a member of the society, for him it's clear which is the worst outcome. Now that is faithfulness. You know, these are interesting times. This is a time when, let me take a minute to reflect back to the last change in administration where you had 8 years of a Democratic administration and then a new Republican administration arriving, 2001. Many of the folks in this room were here then. You had the new administration, the George W. Bush administration coming in, and as Dean mentioned, I had the privilege of going over to the Federal Trade Commission. Tim Muris was the brand newly appointed chairman, and Tim, I had gotten to know Tim from working with him on the campaign. I was at DOJ at the time, and Tim called me and reached out, and I came over to join him running the policy office. And it was an interesting time, summer of 2001. New leadership team at the agency, and it was an interesting illustration, I think, of how principled leadership, focusing on first principles, can make a positive and meaningful impact. Now, one of the first things I did coming into the office is, well, you gotta recruit a team. You gotta bring a team in. We're trying to figure out who. I'll tell you, Tim said, well, I'll tell you one person you need to look out for, is there is this star lawyer in Commissioner Orson Swindle's office. Her name's Maureen Olhausen. You guys may have heard of her. She clerked for Judge Sentell. She's been at the commission. She's smart. She's principled. And one of the very first things I did showing up was recruited Maureen, come leave the commissioner's office, come join the policy office. She joined early on. John Delacorte, who's here, is another one who came and joined us early on. We had an early band. Jerry Ellig came and joined as my deputy. He later became head of the policy office. Maureen became head of the policy office. Todd Zwicky became head of the policy office. Must be an easy job because everyone can do it. But what was interesting about the FTC then, and I think there's insight to be derived now 16 years later with yet again another new administration coming in, is then Chairman Muris gave a mandate for that agency. The statutory mandate of the FTC is to defend competition, defend consumers. He gave a mandate, let's go out and think aggressively, vigorously, how can we do it? So, for example, one of the things we did in the policy office is we created an internet task force focusing on barriers to e-commerce. And we looked all across the economy at all sorts of areas of exploding opportunity, of small businesses giving new opportunity to people who want to achieve the American dream. And at industry after industry after industry, we looked at the regulatory barriers that get put in place. That's something Clark Neely at IJ has spilled much blood fighting against, and he's a long and old-time friend. But we look at industry after industry where you had the same pattern, which is bricks and mortar producers, those with power and influence, those that tended to be listened to by state regulators, by state legislatures, who would put in place barriers to entry to prevent new entrants. One of the things we did together was hosting 3 days of public hearings on barriers to e-commerce, looking at 10 different industries, and it was amazing. We actually compiled in each of the different industries where we heard testimony, there was at least one witness who would say, you know, I looked at the other nine industries. And the barriers we're seeing to e-commerce, those are terrible. They're clearly unjustified. It's obviously protectionism. It's obviously sticking it to consumers. But our industry's different. And we actually compiled in all 10, there was at least one witness who said exactly that. Our industry, there is a special reason. You know, you looked at funeral directors. A lot of state laws that say you got to be a licensed funeral director to sell a casket. Now, last time I checked, a casket's a box. Pretty sure a seventh grade shop class can make a box. But you got to understand the market. In the funeral business, there's a good margin. If you put some satin on that box, now we're talking real dollars. And so prohibiting anyone who wasn't a funeral director from selling a casket, well, that's pretty good for the funeral directors because, you know, if you want to go learn how to embalm someone, now that's a very different story. We saw that pattern over and over and over again. And one of the things the FTC did, actually the Policy Planning Office did, that we worked together on was something called competition advocacy. It's a phenomenal, simple, and yet powerfully subversive idea, which is the mandate Chairman Muras gave, was if there are anti-competitive state laws, regulations that are hurting consumers, the FTC would respond to an invitation from a state legislator, from a state board, to come in and testify and study it. At the time, there were 75 PhD economists, the FTC, so we'd study a given law. We'd look at it, come in and testify, and we'd say, look, you guys are welcome to do anything you like, but under the analysis of our economist, if this particular regulation is passed, if this particular law is passed, it's going to end up negatively impacting your consumers to the tune of, say, $45 million a year. And it's an amazing thing. The proponents of the laws and regs, they were never happy when we showed up. But it was never using the coercive force of government. Wasn't the federal government coming in and bigfooting and saying, you can't do this. It was simply shining a light. And as an old phrase, that sunshine is the most powerful disinfectant. You'd simply shine a light. And, you know, it's a little bit like what happens when you turn on the light in the kitchen and cockroaches go and scatter. Bad laws and policies get made typically in the dark of night without anyone watching. And over again, we'd come in and just testify, look, if you really want to screw your consumers, hey, knock yourself out. But here's what it's going to do. And almost without exception, when we'd come in and testify, the anti-competitive rule or regulation wouldn't be adopted. That simply shining a light at the invitation of the state or local leaders who would ask us to come in, simply shining a light and focusing on the harms. You know, you look at another area, the interstate sale of wine. It's an area we got very involved in. Now, you know, I still recall a good friend of mine in this town who was very involved with the wholesalers, was very upset. Why are you looking at this issue? And it was very interesting, the arguments that were given against the interstate sales of wine. You know, you look at wineries. Wineries are exploding. The opportunity. Texas, we've got hundreds of wineries that are opening. Wineries all over the country. But yet the arguments that were given, and it was a series of arguments. One of the arguments I found most interesting was that, well, the interstate sale of wine will increase underage drinking. Now, that always struck me that anyone making that argument has never actually met a teenager. I will readily concede the online sale of beer kegs, that could be an issue. But I've never met a 16-year-old who says, I'd really like a nice perky Cabernet. That's just not living on the world we live on. But, you know, one of the things we did is we said, well, there are a number of states that allow direct shipment. So let's contact their alcohol boards. Ask them, have you seen a problem with underage drinking? Has this contributed to it in every way? And one after the other, they responded to the request, and the answer was the same over and over again. No, 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 no. We heard testimony on it. Ended up preparing a report. Actually, Maureen helped lead that effort to prepare the report. It's over a 100-page report detailing the harm. Consumers paying more for that product because of those barriers. Now, again, the report was not using the coercive power of government. It was simply shining a light. Here are the facts. But fascinatingly enough, that report, a couple of years later, the issue made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the court ended up striking down some of the barriers to interstate shipment. And that report, written in the policy shop of the FTC, I think it was cited by Justice Kennedy, if I remember correctly, a dozen times in the majority opinion. It's an example where telling the truth makes a big difference. Now, this lunch is about economic liberty, as I understand it. Listen, the truth is economic liberty works. Economic liberty is what provides opportunity. My number one priority in the Senate is and always has been jobs and economic growth. For the very simple reason that the 27 million Texans I represent, the number one priority for Texans is jobs and economic growth. Everywhere in the state of Texas I go, that's what I hear. From East Texas to West Texas, from the Panhandle to the Rio Grande, Texans want more jobs, higher wages, more opportunity. And, you know, all of us, we tend to think about economic opportunity not as some abstract chart of supply and demand. But we think about it in our families, our lives. For me, I think about it with my dad. My dad, when he came to Texas, it was 1957, and he was 18, couldn't speak English, had $100 sewn in his underwear. And he got a job washing dishes, making 50 cents an hour. Now, why did he get a job washing dishes? Because he couldn't speak English. You didn't have to speak English to wash dishes. You had to be able to take a dish, put it under hot water, scrub it. He could do that in any language. Now, after a while, my dad learned English. He learned English pretty quickly. Once he learned English, he got his next job. His next job was as a cook at that same restaurant. That was a better job. That paid 80 cents an hour, not 50 cents an hour. And he didn't burn his hands all day long. So he liked that job better. A little while later, he got his next job. His next job was as a teaching assistant at the University of Texas, teaching math. And his next job from there, he got hired as a computer programmer at IBM. And then he and my mom went on to form a small business, a seismic data processing business in the oil and gas industry. Now, you look at that trajectory, and to me, the most striking thing about it is how utterly ordinary it is. How every one of us, I am confident we could come up here and in our families tell the same story. Climbing the economic ladder, that's how it works. But the critical piece to understand from that, you don't start climbing that economic ladder unless you can get on the first rung and the second rung. If he doesn't get hired washing dishes, he doesn't get that second job as a cook, or the third job, or the fourth job, or the fifth job. It's the entry. I think our focus, for those who believe in the free market, our focus needs to be relentlessly on the most vulnerable, on the people just starting to climb the economic ladder, making it easier to grab that bottom rung, to grab that second rung. You know, you talk about all sorts of issues. You talk about an issue like the minimum wage. I explained the minimum wage this way. If you'd gone back and made the minimum wage in 1957 for my dad $2 an hour, they'd have fired my dad and bought a dishwasher. It's real simple. You can jack up, you can put regulations in place that the people who get fired are the most vulnerable. You know, you look at cities, particularly on the West Coast, that are passing $15 minimum wage laws. You know, I always have a question, well, if you're going to make it 15, how about 50? How about 100? Don't you want people to make $100? Are you mean? Do you not want them to do that? And what's happening? Listen, in any business, you have a trade-off of capital and labor. You're doing a mix of one or the other. And typically, that mix is based on the relative cost of each and what they produce. If you have government regulation driving up the cost of labor, you shift more to capital. How many of you have been to a restaurant and ordered on an iPad? You're looking at a $15 waiter. It's real simple. You don't have to pay an iPad. Some waiter or waitress lost his or her job and got replaced with an iPad. Why? Because the labor became too expensive and they were replaced with capital. That trade-off. And by the way, it's not just, you know, some people, you see proponents of big government saying, oh, well, that job didn't pay enough anyway. Really? Look, my dad didn't want to wash dishes for 50 cents an hour his whole life. Could he have taken care of our family on 50 cents an hour? Probably not. But if he didn't start with that job, he didn't get the next ones. Now, we've got an opportunity in this town to do an enormous amount of good. Where we are today, it's a result of the election. Republicans have been given control of the White House, of every federal agency, and of both houses of Congress. That does not happen often. Historically, that is quite rare. Now, we could do an enormous amount of good, or we could screw it up badly. In my view, there are four big-ticket priority items this year to which I'm devoting virtually all of my time and attention. The first is Obamacare repeal. That's had a rocky few days. But it's important to keep in mind. Number one, we have got to get it done. Failure is not an option. You can't spend 6 years campaigning every day telling the voters, if you elect us, we'll do this, and then don't do it. And it's worth remembering, look, the House plan didn't have the votes last week. That House plan had been public for 18 days. 18 days does not a final product make. The task in Congress is very simple, to sit down and bring people together. Focus on common ground of how to get the task done. There are actually a lot of areas of consensus dealing with Obamacare repeal. It's what I've been focusing on for the last several weeks, is sitting down in hundreds of meetings with House members, with senators, with the president, with the vice president, with members of the administration, saying, let's look at the common grounds about how do we do, what do we want to do? We want to expand options, we want to expand competition, we want to empower consumers, we want to lower premiums. My biggest disagreement with the House plan is it didn't lower premiums. The number one cause of unhappiness, of dissatisfaction with Obamacare, is premiums are too high. Average families' premiums have increased over $5,000 a year. What I hear from Texans every day, people say, I can't afford health insurance. The test for success on Obamacare repeal, the biggest test for success will be, do we drive those premiums down? And how do you drive the premiums down? You drive the premiums down by getting rid of the legal mandates that drove them up in the first place. By expanding choices, expanding competition, repealing the insurance mandates, allowing purchases across state lines, allowing association health plans, allowing people to pay for health insurance premiums from health savings accounts so you're paying with pre-tax dollars. Now, what's striking is of the ideas I just rattled off there, and this is a wonky enough group that I can actually do it without a paragraph of explanation on each of those, most of them have virtual unanimity, at least among Republicans. And yet most of those ideas were not in the House plan. How do you get common ground? I got a crazy idea. How about we start with consensus? What does everyone agree with? Okay, good. Let's start with that. There are a lot of good ideas that could lower premiums and expand choices. We need to start with that, and I believe we're going to get it done. Second big thing this year is reg reform. That's going to be, I suspect, a big topic of this panel discussion. It's a big topic of the folks here. Let me tell you, reg reform may be the single thing I'm most optimistic about this new administration. Almost without exception, every new cabinet member when he or she has sat down with me, the first words out of their mouth have been regulatory reform. By all indications, the commitment to reg reform is real, it is serious, it's genuine. And so let me make an invitation to you guys. I would welcome from each of you smart, creative, outside-the-box ideas. Alden, thinking about ways to get to change the terrain. And not just sort of the ordinary legislative agenda. But on reg reform, how can we change the underlying terrain so that you don't see anti-competitive, anti-consumer regulations? And I would encourage you, reach out to our office and give your creative ideas. Listen, this is a president who wants to be bold. Boldness is a great characteristic in a president. So we have the opportunity, I think, for really path-breaking reg reform that I hope changes the trajectory of the regulatory state so that you don't see a constantly proliferating mass of federal regulations strangling small businesses and opportunity. If you want job creation, reg reform is a vital piece to it. Third critical priority this year is tax reform. I think we are likely to pass significant tax reform either this summer or fall. Now, the contours of it, the details of it, are very much up for debate. There's disagreement within the House, within the Senate, between the House and the Senate, and with the administration. Other than that, everyone's on the same page. But you know what? We can get that done, too. And in fact, I think we get it done the same way we get Obamacare done, by starting with areas of consensus. I'll tell you what I have shared with the president on tax reform is two words, bold and simple. I think there's power to bold simplicity. And the combination, by the way, of reg reform and tax reform, if done right and with Obamacare repeal, will unleash this economy. It has the potential to create millions of new jobs, high-paying jobs to raise wages. And the fourth big thing is confirming a strong conservative to replace Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. Now, next week, the Senate will take up Judge Gorsuch, and I believe next week, we will confirm Neil Gorsuch as the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. If we do that, we repeal Obamacare, have significant reg reform, major tax reform, and confirm a strong conservative of the Supreme Court, if we do all of that in 2017, 2017 will be a blockbuster year. This has the potential to be the most productive Congress in decades. On the other hand, if we screw those four up, 2017 could be a heartbreaking missed opportunity. So that's what the stakes are. And I'm excited, I'm energized to be in the arena working to get it done. And I'll say the terrain is very different. You know, the week after the election, I sat down with my Senate staff. And I said, listen, for the last 4 years, we have had a radical and extreme president who did not care what Congress thought, who did not care what the American people thought, and was trying to jam through an agenda that was hurting millions of Americans. And our job was to be the loyal opposition, to do everything we could to fight to stop harmful policies that were hurting Texans, that were hurting jobs, that were hurting people across this country. I said, I thought we did a pretty effective job doing that. But what I continued to my staff is I said, you know what? The entire world changed on Election Day. Now our task is very different. Now our task is to deliver on what was promised, to actually get accomplished what we've been talking about forever and ever and ever. It's not easy, but it is an exciting task to have before us. And so I want to invite from each of you creative, energetic, outside-the-box thoughts, suggestions. Reach out to our staff. If you have ideas on how we can make a bold, creative idea a bold, creative change that will expand economic liberty, expand opportunity, expand jobs, raise wages. That is our priority. And I think the men and women in this room have a lot of the knowledge and expertise to help get it done. With that, I'll answer a couple questions. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. One quick, not necessarily a question, but actually a suggestion for you immediately. I'm Larry Spywick from the Phoenix Center, one of the panelists today. I guess it was a couple weeks ago, we updated a study we did in 2010. And we found, looking at over 50 years of data, that if you just do a 10% cut to the regulatory budget, about a little over $5 billion, you pick up annually $1.2 trillion in GDP growth and over 3 million private sector jobs a year. In fact, we calculate on a per regulator basis, one regulator kills 138 private sector jobs. So an easy way of doing it is just cut the budget. That way you don't, the theory is, because we all know about getting into cost-benefit analysis, we're assuming that the regulatory agency will do one correctly. But the theory is that with perhaps fewer resources, the regulator will be more judicious in their interventions. So I commend you to look at that. We have empirics to back that up, and I'll get it to your staff.
Yeah, please do get that report to us. You know, I will tell a lousy joke that the reporters who are on the campaign trail with me heard way too much. But it's actually a true story of, you know, years ago when I was campaigning for Senate out in West Texas. And I asked folks there, I said, what's the difference between regulators and locusts? I said, the thing is, you can't use pesticide on the regulators. And this old West Texas farmer, he leaned forward, said, want to bet?
There have been, I don't know if you call them rumors or disagreements or whatever, circulating a long time in the legal community. And that's as to whether or not, as an advocate, I mentioned you're an advocate in the Supreme Court, you wore cowboy boots when you argued. So maybe you could set the record straight.
Well, let me say, Dean, you know, it's the great thing about coming to the FedSoc is to hear those kind of negative assaults. The viciousness and attacks of Washington. So there is actually a story on that. So when I was Solicitor General of Texas, I had a pair of black Lucchese ostrich boots, in fact, pretty much identical to the boots I'm wearing right now, that were my argument boots that I wore for every argument I did. So Texas Supreme Court, Fifth Circuit, District Court, I wore my argument. And so it was October 7th, 2003. It was my first U.S. Supreme Court argument. I was 32, and the Chief Justice was my former boss, Chief Justice Rehnquist. And I'm thinking about that argument, trying to decide, all right, you know, trying to get ready for it. My big question was, okay, do I wear my boots? Now, here's the problem. I love Chief Justice Rehnquist. He was an incredible friend and mentor, was a legal giant. But not everyone knows he was also a stickler for attire. He cared a great deal. As law clerks, we could dress sort of business casual during the week, but he did not like, you've got your undershirt showing? He would look at us and he'd say, no, why are you wearing your undershirt? You know they sell these things called V-necks. And one of my co-clerks, Rick Garnett, who's a professor at Notre Dame now, Rick said, well, Chief, look, in this day and era, it's considered gauche to have your chest hair sticking out. And the chief said, no, you look like an auto mechanic. So we all went out and purchased V-necks, and he had lawyers would appear at the podium at the court in a brown suit, and the chief had begun the argument by reprimanding the lawyer. So I'm thinking about the argument. I'm already nervous as all get out. And as much as I love the chief, I did not want the first argument to begin for me to stand up and say, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, and have him interrupt me and say, counsel, that footwear is not appropriate in this courtroom. So I am ashamed to say, I am embarrassed that I went and pulled out an old pair of wingtips that was covered in dust, shined them up, and put on my wingtips like a craven coward, and did not argue in my boots. And so the first four arguments of the court, I wore wingtips. It's the only place I didn't argue in boots. And then fast forward to when the Chief Justice dies, and John Roberts replaced him. And I'd known John a long time. John was also a clerk for Rehnquist. And so I saw John, actually at the Chief's funeral is where we had this conversation. And he had been nominated to be Chief Justice. And I said, Chief, I guess I was feeling a little cheeky. I said, do you happen to have any views on the appropriateness of boots as footwear at oral argument? And John smiled and he said, Ted, if you're representing the state of Texas, they're not only appropriate, they're required. And so the next five arguments, I wore my argument boots, but only with special dispensation from the Chief Justice.
Nice follow-up question. Did you notice any difference in performance or outcome in those cases?
Dramatically.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
By the way, the one other time I didn't wear them, I wear these almost every day on the Senate floor too, and the one other time I didn't wear them was during the Obamacare filibuster, where I confessed about 3 in the morning, I on C-SPAN confessed to the 4 people watching that I was not wearing my argument boots, and I actually sent an apology to the people of Texas that their Texan senator had so little courage of convictions. And the story I relayed is before the filibuster, I talked to Rand Paul. Remember, Rand had done a long filibuster not long before that. And Rand had given me 2 pieces of advice. He said, number one, wear comfortable footwear, which Rand did not. And he said his feet and legs hurt him for a week afterwards. And then he said, number two, don't drink very much water. The whole anything that comes in comes out. Right. Rand says it wasn't his legs that took him down. It was his bladder. Right. So in 21 hours, I drank 1 little glass of water the whole time. But I went out and bought a pair of black tennis shoes, and about 2 or 3 in the morning, I admitted to the people of Texas. I said, I'm sorry that my calves lacked the courage or strength to stand here 21 hours on boots.
Let's make this the last question, if we could.
Ted Gebhardt. Monetary policy isn't often considered part of the regulatory state, but I'd argue that the Fed is indeed one of the most significant regulators of our economy, controlling both the money supply and exercising price controls in the form of setting interest rates. During the campaign, you, on more than one occasion that I can recall, said that you were in favor of sound money. Two-part question. What do you mean by sound money? It's been over 40 years now since we've been on just fiat money. And secondly, what do you see in the future in terms of prospects of reforming the Fed, if not ending the Fed? I think you even said one time that you were in favor of returning to the gold standard.
So, Ted, thank you for that question. And I'll note, Ted was another part of our merry band at the FTC back in the early 2000s taking on these regulations. It's good to see you again. Look, it's a very good question. You know, when it comes to monetary policy is one of those things that a lot of people, it's sort of their eyes cloud over. It seems really complicated to a lot of folks. And you hear debates about, do we want a strong dollar or a weak dollar? And my view is we don't want either one. We want a stable dollar. A dollar is a unit of measurement. You know, Steve Forbes has a great analogy. It's like asking, in time, an hour is a unit of measurement. Do you want a long hour or a short hour? You don't want either. You want an hour to be 60 minutes every single time without variance, because it is against that hour that you are measuring the allocation of time. The same is true with a dollar. It is against that dollar that you're measuring the allocation of goods, the allocation of services. And so you want stability and consistency. And the current Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve's predecessors, we have had PhD economists monkeying with the value of the dollar. And you see the dollar going up, you see the dollar going down, you see interest rates going up and then going down. That up and down creates enormous dislocation, causes enormous harms in the economy where people make investments, they count on the value. You look at farmers, you look at ranchers, you look at anyone in the commodity world where farm prices can skyrocket and then plummet. And if you happen to have invested when prices were high and you thought you were going to get a good price and then the prices plummet by the time you're selling, a whole lot of farmers lose their farms. And if you look at the history of the Fed, of the smartest guys in the room trying to figure out the economy, look, I'm with Socrates. Socrates quite wisely understood that the heart of wisdom is knowing what you don't know, having the humility to say what you don't know. And I think the Fed, likewise, the record of booms and busts has not gotten better with monetary policy fluctuating dramatically. So in my view, we ought to look towards moving towards a rules-based monetary policy that focuses on stability. And I think part of that, the gold standard should be part of that examination. Gold standard is one rules-based system. There are other rules-based systems you could construct. But we ought to be comparing the record of economic growth under previous monetary systems that provided greater stability versus the enormous up and down volatility that we've seen under the Fed. And the prospects of that, I don't know. It has not been an issue the administration has voiced significant views on that I have seen. So where the administration's views will be, and there may be multiple views among multiple players within the administration, I don't know. It will certainly be something that I will continue focusing on, that I suspect others in the Senate and in Congress will focus on. And I do think it's an issue that resonates with people. People understand, you know, one aspect working people understand is the impact of inflation, that their cost of living has gone up. And that without their wages following. And so I think monetary stability, sound money, is incredibly important. I think it's something, it is an additional component when you talk about how you get economic growth, when you talk about the Reagan miracle. And that's actually a good thing to close on. Since World War II, our economy has grown on average 3.3% a year. That's been the average growth rate. From 2008 to 2012, the economy grew on average 0.9% a year, less than 1%. The only previous four-year period where growth averaged less than 1% a year was 1978 to 1982. It's coming out of the Jimmy Carter administration. It was the same failed economic policies, out of control spending, taxes, regulation. And if you look at what happened, Reagan came in 1981, right in the middle of that period. What policies did he pursue? He pursued reg reform. He pursued tax reform, dramatically simplifying the tax code, bold and simple, bold simplicity, and sound money. He brought stability to our money supply. Four years later, 1984. Does anyone know what economic growth was in 1984? Look, those are crazy numbers. 7.2%. Those are developing world numbers. We've come through 8 years of Obama growth, 1 and 2% stagnant growth. My view as policymakers, as legislators, we ought to be targeting for the next 4 years at least 5% GDP growth. By the way, JFK campaigned on 5% GDP growth and achieved it in office, JFK, through doing what? Through tax cuts and reg reform. These policies work. And so in the toolkit we have, if we are bold, if we achieve the four big things I said we could achieve this year, I think 5% GDP growth is entirely within reach. And every other challenge we have, if you want to rebuild the military, as I do, if you want to strengthen and reform Social Security and Medicare as I do, if you want infrastructure, if you want to pay down our debt and deficits, the key to all of that is growth. And so this is a room of smart people focused on economic liberty and geeky enough to know what APA stands for. If we think boldly and creatively, we can unleash the free enterprise system, and that is an incredible thing. Thank you.